From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a nun who counsels inmates on Louisiana's death row. Sister Helen Prejean doesn't fit the inmate stereotypes of nuns. Her approach to spiritual guidance doesn't focus on quoting scripture. She'll tell us what keeps her working with men who have committed horrible crimes. Also today, men, women, and aggression. We talk with psychologist and criminologist Ann Campbell about why women think being angry means they're losing control and why men think anger helps them gain control. And the new Broadway cast album of The Who's Tommy. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Rain and thunderstorms spread across the upper Mississippi Valley today, prompting flash flood warnings and aggravating the flooding along the Mississippi and its tributaries. The already flooded area around Des Moines, Iowa, reported more than an inch of rain in many places. About 250,000 people in the area spent their third day without safe drinking water today after floodwaters contaminated the city's water treatment plant. Electric power has been restored to most of the 50,000 people who were without power on Sunday. Damages to the seven states hit by the flooding are estimated in the $3 billion range so far. Congress was back at work today on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers have less than 4 weeks to pass President Clinton's $500 billion deficit reduction package and a series of other measures before the August recess. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
House and Senate negotiators will begin their real work on the budget plan on Thursday behind closed doors. Meanwhile, both chambers will take up other legislation. Today, the Senate began work on easing restrictions of the Hatch Act, a measure passed in 1949 to protect civil servants from partisan pressure by limiting their political activities. The Senate is considering changes to allow federal workers to run for election to party office or serve as delegates or campaign officials. The House began debate on President Clinton's National Service Plan today, which would provide tuition for young people who participate in volunteer work programs. In addition, the House plans to finish work this week on the 1994 appropriation bills, sending them on to the Senate. But both houses plan to finish up early tonight so that members could catch professional baseball's All-Star game in nearby Baltimore. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Islamic nations have pledged 18,000 troops to join the peacekeeping efforts in the former Yugoslavia. The Islamic Conference Organization made the announcement today after a two-day meeting in Islamabad. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Pakistan hosted the meeting and announced that 16 governments had agreed to an action plan. The cornerstone of the plan offers troops to police the so-called safe areas in Bosnia. Iran pledged the largest force, followed by Turkey and Pakistan. Pakistan foreign minister stressed that this was not an Islamic shield, but a shield from the United Nations. He said troops could be ready to go in 6 weeks, provided their mandate was clear and that they were provided with the proper equipment. The final communique from the conference stated that the Islamic governments would not take part in any plan to partition the country or to create refugee ghettos in Bosnia-Herzegovina. In Ankara, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points to close at 3,515. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up 0.8 of a point at 708.48. This is NPR. The American Bar Association gave President Clinton's nominee to the Supreme Court its highest rating today. The ABA said that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is well qualified to be the second woman on the 9-member court. The association sent its report to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which will begin confirmation hearings on her nomination on July 20th. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt has announced an agreement aimed at saving the Florida Everglades by placing safeguards against development and agricultural pollution. NPR's John Nielsen reports that Florida's sugarcane growers will bear most of the costs.
Runoff from sugarcane farms has long been linked to fish kills and habitat changes in Florida's Everglades. But for years, these farmers have sued to avoid paying the lion's share of restoration costs. Today, after meeting for months with state and federal officials, representatives of the cane industry agreed to drop the lawsuits and pay as much as $322 million to get pollutants out of farm runoff. Interior Secretary Babbitt said the payments would anchor an ambitious Everglades restoration program designed to save fish and wildlife and restore more natural flows of water. Farmers said they'd agreed to pay in return for a promise that they wouldn't be asked to pay more later. But environmental groups objected on grounds that they hadn't been asked to participate in the negotiations. Babbitt said final details of the tentative agreement would be worked out in 90 days. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
Italy asked the United Nations today for permission to withdraw its troops from Mogadishu unless agreement can be reached on the mission of the UN force in Somalia. Italy, which is Somalia's former colonial ruler, has more than 2,000 soldiers there. The Italian news media and opposition parties have strongly criticized UN tactics in Somalia. They blame the United States for the aggressive UN stance, which calls for disarming rival clans. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1984, Elmo Patrick Saunier was executed for killing two young people he had abducted from Lover's Lane with his brother. My guest sister, Helen Prejean, was Saunier's spiritual advisor. Since his execution, she's continued to work with death row inmates at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola and to publicly oppose the death penalty. She says a person's humanity transcends the worst act he has ever committed. Sister Prejean is a Roman Catholic nun. Her prison work dates back to 1982. She was living and working among the poor in a New Orleans housing project when a member of the prison coalition asked her if she would correspond with a death row inmate. The inmate was Saunier. The correspondence led to visits. The visits led her to an enduring commitment to working with men facing execution. She's written a new book about her work called Dead Man Walking. Before Saunier was executed, Prejean came to believe it was his brother who killed the young couple. We talked about her work, and she told me about her very first visit to death row.
I was traumatized by my first visit, I have to tell you. I was frightened. First of all, the sign you read as you go in saying that, you know, by coming onto the prison property, you subject yourself to a strip search and your body cavities and dogs and the whole bit. And it's like it traumatized me. And I kept thinking, oh, God, maybe because I'm a nun, they'll cut me some slack. But I wasn't sure. And then as they brought me into the prison itself and onto death row, just to see the building and know that it was a building devoted to housing people who were condemned to die and waiting to die. And then when I saw, as the guard and I rounded a corner, and there were these red block letters over a green door with bars, and it said death row. I still remember seeing those words for the first time. Like, here is a section where condemned human beings live and wait to die, wait to be killed.
Can you tell us what your first meeting with Saunier was like?
I'll never forget it. I was pacing up and down. Well, they locked me in a room after they had brought me through all these gates, and I was pacing up and down because it was September. It's still hot in Louisiana in September. There's a huge fan going, and I was looking in these six booths. They look like telephone booths with heavy mesh wire to separate you from the prisoner. And I was just pacing. I had on my little heels, and I could hear the clop of my heels back and forth on the cement floor. I was a little afraid of him. I'd seen a picture of him, and it had shown him kind of scowling, and the picture had scared me. And I remember thinking, I'm glad he's in prison. I don't want him to be executed, but I'm glad he's in prison. So I paced up and down and waited, and then I heard his voice coming down the tier with a guard, teasing the guard, because he was a Cajun. I could hear this Cajun French accent. And I heard his voice before I saw him, and I could hear the chains. His legs were shackled. I could hear the chains as they came across the floor. And then I looked up, and there he was. And he had showered, and he was shaved, and his hair was combed, and his face was so open, and it had a kindness in it and a gratitude. And he said, "Sister, I am so glad to see you," because I think he hadn't had a visitor in over 6 or 9 months. And then I eased up a little bit, because he was so glad to see someone that he talked a lot, and I realized that all I had to do was really listen and be present to him.
Do you have to believe in somebody's innocence to work with them?
No. In fact, I went in assuming that he was guilty. I go to death row assuming that people are guilty. But to me, one of the moral issues of the death penalty is not so much whether or not we will not execute the innocent, but it's how do we treat the guilty? That, to me, is the moral question that we face with in the death penalty.
You work with prisoners and with families of their victims. Do you sometimes see the prisoners differently after you've spoken with the families of the victims and you've tried to empathize with them and see the crime through their eyes and see the prisoner through their eyes?
Yeah, it produces, I would say that it's probably the worst tension that I've ever felt in my life, is to have been with the victims and known their pain and their grief, and to walk in the room with the person who murdered their child. Because I feel them inside of me, and partly the way I feel their presence is that I have to fight back the guilt of being compassionate to someone who has done so terrible a thing. But the life forces are stronger than the hate forces. And granted, this is easier for me to say than them. If there's a hero in the book, it's Lloyd LeBlanc, who forgave the people who murdered, you know, his son. He knelt by his body's, the son of his body, and said, "Whoever did this, I forgive them." But it's a terrible tension. And I feel in myself the social pressure that the death penalty is. And I can understand how victims' families, they've lost someone they love so much. And here society says to them, "Well, because we value the life of your child, which has been so terribly taken from you, we want to exert the maximum penalty. How do you feel about that?" Well, all that love comes to bear, and you say, "Yes, the maximum penalty," because the maximum penalty is a measure of how much you loved your child. I think the formula gets written out that way, and people respond to that. In fact, I know of there are some murder victims' families who are against the death penalty that call murder victims' families for reconciliation, and Marietta Yeager, who's one of those people, her daughter, 9-year-old daughter, was brutally murdered, and she was on a talk show one time with some other victims' families who wanted the death penalty, and she did not want the death penalty. And at the end of the talk show, one of them said to her, "It's a shame you didn't love your daughter the way we loved ours," because that love is translated into people wanting the death penalty. And I see it as one of the factors that would make victims' families say, "Yes, of course we want the death penalty."
Is this the kind of thing you might talk about with parents of victims?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we talk about everything. I mean, there are two stories I tell in the book were about two people who were executed, Pat Saunier and Robert Lee Willie. Pat Saunier's victim's family, one of the victim's families I have grown close to. With Robert Lee Willie, a young woman was brutally raped and murdered, Faith Hathaway, and her mother, Elizabeth Harvey, and her stepfather, Vernon Harvey. When we would be doing marches and campaigns against the death penalty, the Harveys were always waiting for us at the end of every march we did, and they had a sign that said, "What about the victims?" And Vernon Harvey said to me one time, he said, "Here you are, you've given all your time to these scum. Why don't you come with us to parents of murdered children and come with us to the victims' meetings, and you need to find out what the victims are going through." And he was right, and I went with them. And I was amazed at these meetings that I went to of what the victims' families have suffered. First, I was amazed that they felt abused by the criminal justice system as well as people in prison. Their phone calls weren't returned. In a way, I could see that the prosecutors who were going after the death penalty, it was the state versus the defendant, and the victims were out of the loop of the whole process. And so they didn't know how to deal with victims. Victims are not a vital part of the criminal justice process in prosecuting for the death penalty. And then they had to go through the trial. Of course, DAs, when they press for the death penalty, they want that victim's family there in the courtroom, even if they don't say anything. Their presence say, "Remember us, remember our child," and that's an argument, really silent, but an argument for the death penalty. And I see that the death penalty process, they have to go through the trial and relive it, then they have to wait for the appeals, and it's hard for them to find closure of their grief. It may be delayed 6 years, 7 years. I remember one time a victim's family, before Dalton Prejean was executed, she said, "When will our grief end? When will this execution take place?" And of course, what the state promises victims in Louisiana, victims' families can witness the execution. And what they say to them is, okay, your child's life has been taken, justice will be done, we will allow you to witness the execution, and then you will experience justice and vindication for your child's life. And one of the stories in the book of the Harveys, of Vernon and Elizabeth Harvey, Vernon and I both witnessed Robert Lee Willie's execution. I was there as his spiritual advisor. Vernon and Elizabeth were both there to watch him die as the parents. And then afterwards, there were a lot of media people there, and the TV people came up to Vernon Harvey with their mics because he had publicly said, I can't wait to see him fry, you know. And they said, well, Mr. Harvey, you watched Robert Lee Willie die. How do you feel now? And he said, it felt good to see him die. And then he added, the son of a bitch died too quick. I hope he burns in hell. And I have been visiting the Harvey since then. It's like I realize he could have watched Robert Lee Willie die 1,000 times, and he still has to deal with the loss of Faith, his daughter, and that nothing can ever replace her.
Yeah. The first execution you witnessed was the execution of Elmo Patrick Saunier, who was also the first death row prisoner that you worked with.
Right.
Did you decide to watch or not watch when you were in that room as the electric chair was turned on?
When Pat and I had talked about it, first I was shocked that he was going to be executed. I just never dreamed it would happen because we hadn't had many executions in Louisiana. You know, this was in 1984. And so I said to him one time, I said, well, Pat, if you do die, I will be there with you. I want you to be able to see a loving face. And he went, oh, no, sister. He said, you know, that could harm you. This is going to be terrible. And I went, no. There's no question about it. I will be there with you. Then when I was actually in the chamber, I walked with him, you know, to the chair and read the scripture from Isaiah 43. If you walk through the sea, I'll be with you. God's words of comfort to him. And then they brought him into the execution chamber, and I was right behind him, and I kissed him on the back. I was leaving him, and I said, Pat, pray for me. And he turned around, and he said, Sister Helen, I will. And then I went and sat in the witness chamber, and he could see me. He could see my face. And they strapped them in. They strapped the trunk and their legs and their arms. And he reached out his hand to me right before they strapped his right arm. And his last words were to me, I love you. And I remember my arm just raising up, going toward him, saying, I love you too. But then they put a mask over his face. That's to protect the witnesses from the sight of his face when the 1900 volts would hit his body. I knew he couldn't see me anymore, and he knew I was there. And so then I shut my eyes as they pulled the switch.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sister Helen Prejean, and she's the author of the new book, Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty in the United States. She works with prisoners on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, and also sometimes works with the families of the victims. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sister Helen Prejean, who works with prisoners on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. She's the author of the new book, Dead Man Walking. The second prisoner on death row who you began communicating with was Robert Willie. And the first time you went to visit him, he asked you about being celibate, and he asked you if you miss having a man. Those strike me as really suggestive, intimate questions. And I don't know, I think if I were in your shoes, I would have really distrusted the motives of the person asking the questions. How did you handle it?
Well, Robert Lee Willie, I would characterize him as a true outlaw. I mean, he had a swastika on his arm. He belonged to the white Aryan supremacy. He held up Hitler as a hero. He said he hated all people of color And he said to me one time, I'm not just prejudiced against blacks, but against, he named them off, Spicks, Chinks. It was just amazing to me, you know, hit the background and the way that he thought about things. And when we had that conversation, but first of all, I was really kind of hoping when I wrote to him that maybe he didn't want a nun to be his spiritual advisor because he said he never was particularly religiously inclined. And so I wrote to him, but halfway hoping, well, Robert Lee Willie, God, such an outlaw. Surely he is not going to want me, okay? But nope, the letter came back. He said, glad to have the company, and I would like for you to come. So I went. And actually, the tone of that conversation was, it was more he asked it to me really like an amazing question, that somebody would live a celibate life without sex. I mean, he just, it was more like amazed that anybody would even try to do this. And the tone of voice in which he talked to me about it was, you know, one of, you know, God, I love women. He said, I believed in doing it. We'd get us a bottle of bourbon and a blanket. And it was not that you would have to have guests have been there to hear the tone of it. But he just said it in a matter-of-fact voice like that. And then and then that was when I said to him, Robert, you know, by my vow of celibacy, it's like, you know, it's not that I don't love anybody. It's that this way I can spread my love in the human family and not be confined to just one person and one family, like visiting somebody like you. And he kind of laughed, and he says, yeah, he says, I know what you mean. And I only had 2 months with him before he was executed, and there are many very interesting conversations which I tried to record very exactly in the book because he was such an unusual person, and I'd never dealt with anybody quite like him. I was very honest with him, too, about confronting him with the heinousness of what he had done, the terribleness of it.
Okay, so here's somebody who's, you know, not only a white supremacist, but also committed these horrible crimes, and the more details you hear about his personality, the more truly reprehensible
Absolutely.
He becomes. So what kind of relationship did you want to have with him? What did you feel you could do for him? And what did you find anything in him that transcended all these horrible things that we've been discussing?
One of the things I did with Robert Willie was I was just very straightforward with him. I just said, you have committed one of the most heinous crimes imaginable to human beings. I mean, look at Faith Hathaway stabbed 17 times and raped and her parents. See, because one of the things that happened with Robert Willie is that Vernon Harvey was holding his own press conferences and saying publicly how he couldn't wait to see Robert Willie die. And
Vernon Harvey was a step-parent of one of the victims.
The stepfather of Faith Hathaway. And so Robert Willie got into that with Vernon Harvey, saying, well, like, he's his own worst enemy, man. He ought to just let this go. I mean, he's saying he ought to let this go when, I mean, this was such a terrible crime. He and Joe Vaccaro had participated in this. And I'm saying, let this go. What are you saying? Do you realize, like, what these parents have suffered? And then I asked him, I said, suppose somebody did this to your mother. How would you feel? He said, I would want him executed. I mean, he didn't even hesitate. And then he got off on the thing of that anybody that kills children, he would want to see them executed. Like, he had his own code, too. Anyway, and I just said to him, Robert, before you die, if there's one thing, it's you need to apologize to these people. You know, you need to tell them in some way that you're sorry for what happened to their daughter. And one of the things I bring out in the book is, see, the death penalty, he was fleeing for his life in a way, but trying to be tough because he's under the gun now. Somebody's after him trying to kill him. And I find that it's harder to experience remorse when he's in, like, flight with his own life. His own life is being threatened, and he knows he's going to die. So he's trying to put up this tough Marlboro Man front. And I think his harshness and the way he was talking about Vernon Harvey was part of that.
So, but in all honesty, it sounds to me like he doesn't have to put up a front. I mean, he is hardened. He doesn't have to fake it.
Well, a couple of things happened with Robert Willie, though, before he died. One of them was, at one point he said to me, well, okay, he said, one thing I do hope for sincerely, I hope my death gives the Harveys some peace. And I seized on that. I said, At least you're saying there that by your dying, you hope that they will have peace. And in fact, before he was executed, his last words were to them, and he said, I hope my dying gives you peace.
When you witnessed Saunier's execution, you closed your eyes. What about when you witnessed Robert Lee Willie's execution?
Well, it's like I had been through it once, and so then when I was with Robert Lee Willie, I was there as a witness, and I had more strength to me because I had been through it once, and I watched everything with Robert. I didn't close my eyes, and I watched, and as the current hit his body, see, they strapped their chin close, very tight, to hold their jaw together, so they're really silent, they can't speak, and they have their body strapped in the chair, and as the bolts hit his whole body like heaved in the chair, and the straps contained him, and I remember thinking to myself, it takes a long time to make a human being, and it only takes a few seconds to turn it into trash. Not that I condoned in any way what Robert Willie did. What he did was atrocious in any way that we can in our society. I do believe that people who commit such violent crimes need to be imprisoned, long-term imprisonment. But to watch such a premeditated, violent taking of human life, I was just so struck by how wrong that was. In the first execution, you know, Warden Maggio, when he announced the time of death, his eyes happened to meet mine, and he lowered his eyes. And, you know, partly what I tell in Dead Man Walking is my encounters with all these people in the process, from the warden, the governor, the head of the pardon board, and most of the people I encountered in that process who had to carry it out did not feel good about what they did. They felt some shame.
The electric chair in Louisiana has been abandoned for lethal injection. Many people find lethal injection more humane. Do you think it makes a difference?
God, I mean, I bring that out in a book. You know, if you're on a gurney waiting for three chemicals to kill you, one to stop your heart, the other to stop your breathing, or if you're waiting for an electric current, or you're waiting for a bullet, or you're waiting for gas, it's like the terror of death. The torture in the death penalty is the waiting to die. And Amnesty International has defined torture as an extreme mental or physical assault against a person who's been rendered defenseless. The Eighth Amendment forbids us to practice cruel and unusual punishment. And the killing of a human being consciously like this is the practice of torture. It is mental torture. What most death row inmates say by the time they die, they've been through the process maybe three times, being brought into the death chamber at times, maybe hours away from death, given a stay, brought back to begin the process over. And they say, you know, I am so tired preparing for death, their whole family going through with. It's torture. We need to have the honesty to admit that we torture prisoners before we kill them. But the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to do that. And now with the lethal injection, see, you have 21 states now who are doing lethal injection. It's like it's all covered over and made clean. In fact, an associate warden was saying at one point, well, the witness is going to be bored. He said, there's nothing to see, like you're watching somebody go to sleep. And they have like a hospital, white hospital curtain around a gurney now. They cover him over with a sheet. They're trying to make it look like a hospital, like they're putting somebody to sleep, like a horse or something. They probably use alcohol on the person's arm before they put the needle in his arm for the IV, which is just, we want life to be clean. We don't want any blood, and we don't want anything to look like torture. That's to save our own consciences, because it is torture and it is premeditated death.
Sister Helen Prejean is the author of the new book, Dead Man Walking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some people say men are inherently more aggressive than women. Coming up, we talk with Ann Campbell, author of the new book Men, Women, and Aggression. Campbell is a psychologist and criminologist who has studied girl gangs. She says biology can't explain what she's learned about gender and aggression. Also, The Who's Tommy may have racked up 5 Tony Awards and huge box office receipts on Broadway, but how does the music sound to a rock critic? Ken Tucker reviews the new cast recording. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Missouri River is cresting in the central Missouri town of Boonville, where emergency workers are asking volunteers to help out with sandbagging. Residents hope the sandbags will protect them against more rain expected there tonight. In St. Louis, a crest of the Mississippi River is still 5 days away, but officials are still concerned about flooding in the southern part of the city. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports from St. Louis.
The Mississippi River is so full of water that the streams that lead into it, like the River De Pere in St. Louis, are backing up and spilling over their levees. A 60-block area of the south part of St. Louis has been evacuated due to the backwash. Terry Briggs with the Metropolitan Sewer District says more rain is the biggest enemy.
Our pumping situation is designed to handle about a 1-inch rain in a 1-hour period. If we get any more than that, with the system straining already just to contain the floodwaters of the River De Pere, a large rain could really cause some serious problems and some localized heavy flooding in this area.
Crews are manning pumping stations 24 hours a day along the rivers, hoping they can contain the flooding to this limited section of the city. I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
President Clinton is cutting short his vacation in Hawaii to head home and take another look at flood damage in the Middle West. On his way to the Far East, Mr. Clinton stopped off in Iowa. The president said today that the flood damage is much worse than first thought after hearing reports from Vice President Gore, who went to the region yesterday. Mr. Clinton has now directed budget aides to draft a new aid package for flood victims and said it will probably go beyond the $1.2 billion he proposed last week. In Japan, officials say the death toll from yesterday's earthquake and tidal waves has reached 81, and they say the toll is expected to continue to rise. NPR's Marjorie Sun in Tokyo has more on the story.
Police report that at least 82 people are still missing after a strong earthquake late last night hit 30 miles off the coast of Japan's northern island of Hokkaido. The quake, which registered 7.8 on the Richter scale, generated 15-foot-high tidal waves that smashed into coastal villages. A summer resort town on the small island of Okushiri was devastated. Fires triggered by the quake engulfed more than half of the town's 600 homes, most of which were wooden. A hotel there also collapsed, killing at least 8 people inside. Damage was extensive in western and southern Hokkaido, too, where the tidal waves washed away boats, cars, and houses. Japan's Prime Minister Kiichi Miyazawa visited Hokkaido today to inspect the damage. Hundreds of police and government troops have been deployed to help with rescue and cleanup operations. In Tokyo, I'm Marjorie Sun.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 9 points to close at 3,515.44. This is NPR News. U.S. officials say that Secretary of State Warren Christopher will decide in the next day or so whether to head back to the Middle East in new efforts to get Middle Eastern peace talks back on track. Earlier this year, a trip by Christopher resulted in getting negotiations going again. For weeks now, all parties to the talks have refused to change their positions. Apparently, Christopher's objective would be to set up a 10-day negotiating session for early in August. While Christopher has called negotiations stalemated, he told reporters last week in Tokyo that he would be surprised if Labor Day came and went without a trip to the Middle East. French news reports say that pressure is building in France for the nation to resume its nuclear testing in the South Pacific. The French defense minister has not ruled out ending a moratorium, but there is widespread support for a ban among the French public. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The respect Connected Daily Le Monde said top military officials oppose the government's decision to extend its moratorium on nuclear testing. France first announced the moratorium last year for a 12-month period. Then earlier this month, it extended the moratorium, following a decision by the U.S. not to explode devices for 15 more months. Le Monde said the French military establishment resents the government following in the footsteps of the U.S. The paper said officials believe that the U.S. has a state-of-the-art nuclear arsenal, but that France needs to maintain its test to modernize its force. The French defense minister has indicated that he shares this view. But according to a poll cited by Le Monde, two-thirds of the public in France supports maintaining the moratorium. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In the former Soviet Union, Russia has cut off Georgia's international phone service because of non-payment of bills. Last month, Moscow cut off deliveries of natural gas to several Baltic states. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some of our deepest assumptions about gender have to do with aggression, whether it's violence in the streets or violence in the home. My guest Anne Campbell is the author of Men, Women, and Aggression, about how men and women interpret their own acts of violence. Campbell is a British psychologist and criminologist whose other books are Girl Delinquents and The Girls in the Gang. We phoned her in England to discuss the difference in how men and women understand aggression.
I think they just understand it as a completely different process. If you listen to men and women just talking about their everyday experiences of anger, typically the words that they use to describe what's going on are very different from one another. Women are really talking about aggression as if it was a loss of control, as if over a long period of time they were irritated, they were annoyed by something, they held back for as long as they could, and then finally at some point they simply erupt, they go. And at that point, they talk themselves about losing control or being out of control. And often they feel very guilty and upset about what's happened, very remorseful, wish that they could take it back, and so on. But when men talk about aggression, it has a very different kind of feel to it. Aggression for them seems to be a way of exerting control over a situation or over people that are getting away from them. It's very often, I call it instrumental aggression, because it serves very clear sort of ends for men. And one of the ends it serves is gaining control, particularly over their own image, their own self-image. That is, part of the business of being male is the ability to take control and to be in charge. So they see aggression principally as a way of controlling other people when every other avenue breaks down.
Something I find very interesting in your book is you say the biggest sex difference when it comes to anger is that women cry.
Yes.
Do you see crying as a substitute for physical aggression?
What was interesting to me about crying, and it's something that people don't talk about much, certainly psychologists don't talk about much, is that the women spoke about it frequently, and they spoke about it not in terms of remorse, sadness, and so on, but in terms of absolute seething fury. That often when women get to breaking point, the first thing they do, the way they express it, the way they explode, is by crying. It's a particular way of letting go. And one of the interesting things, actually, is that the tears that we cry when we're angry are different from the tears that we cry, for example, when we're slicing an onion. Angry tears are absolutely loaded with adrenaline because our nervous systems are in such a sort of high state of arousal. And so when women say they feel better after a good cry, they probably do, just at a kind of bodily level, because they've discharged some of the kind of stress hormone that was upsetting them. But what's very hard for women is that in, for example, arguments with their husband, when they cry, they are crying out of anger, but it's often misread or misunderstood as crying out of sadness, remorse, and at its worst can actually be read, especially by men, as crying in order to elicit sympathy, as being a tactic, a maneuver that the woman is somehow using.
And how did you reach that conclusion about, that women cry in the same kind of situation that men might get aggressive in?
Well, most of the work that I did here was based on sort of group interviews with women, where I would have a bunch of women who were friends with one another talk amongst themselves about episodes of aggression, what they thought, what they'd felt, and so on. And I wasn't looking at all for the crying thing, but it came up with such frequency, it was absolutely staggering. And in practically all cases, you know, the women said how frustrated they felt at... They thought that they had broken down, that they had lost control, but they were also angry at the way that it was misread, and they were particularly sort of upset when they did it at work. That seemed to be absolutely the worst place to do it, because they felt there that it absolutely ruined any kind of professional credibility that they had fought so hard to get, you know. So it really came up very much in their own words, but in a way, to me, it made some sense, because if you look at the business of losing control, particularly among women who are very much socialized to maintain control, to not let go. One of the interesting things about crying is that it is a way of discharging tension, and it is a way of letting go, which doesn't injure or hurt another person.
My guest is Anne Campbell, author of Men, Women, and Aggression. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with British psychologist Anne Campbell. You spent a few years in the United States, and during part of that time you were studying girl gangs.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to study them?
My original sort of motivation in coming to do it was because at that time, as I say, I was very interested in why some girls should be so violent, particularly because it runs so counter to our idea of what femininity means, what girls are really like. And I came to the States because it seemed to me that there, by looking at gang girls, I could really get to know a bunch of people for whom levels of violence were, but by most young women's standards, extremely high. So I spent 2 years working with three New York gangs, spent a lot of time hanging around with them, listening to them talk, seeing what was going on. I suppose what surprised me more than anything about that experience was just how much their outlook and their talk sounded so much like the boys. And in a back-to-front way, that's what triggered some of this work. I thought, now, why do they sound so different to most women? You know, most women, if they fight or they get to the point of physical violence, will say, oh, God, how could I have done that? How could I have let myself go like that? Oh, God, I must have looked terrible. Oh, what a hysterical bitch I must have seemed. Whereas gang girls were talking about in a very ruthless, cold sort of way like boys did, to do with being somebody, establishing myself. Like if everybody thinks that I'm this sort of crazy woman, then nobody will mess with me, nobody will threaten me.
One thing, an observation you made about the girl gangs that I found very interesting, you said that the major focus of their quest for excitement lay in romances with the boys, and in those romances, the girls assumed a passive role. It's just very paradoxical that girls who so disprove the stereotype of femininity within the relationship with boys would take that passive role.
Yeah, I think the thing is, what I want to say about girls in gangs is that, you know, many other people who've written about women criminals in general have tried to suggest that in some way these are not real women, that they are pseudo-men or something. So there's been a great deal of concern about their self-concept. Are they really masculinized in some way? And what I would argue is it's far, far more specific than that. In most areas of these girls' lives, they are supremely feminine in that sense. You know, they care deeply about their physical appearance. They care deeply about their relationship with men and with their children that they have too. In other words, I don't think it's a question of them turning into pseudo males. I think that what happens is in particular environments, you have to be tough to survive. And being tough in this sense means thinking about violence the way that men do. But that can be quite localized and quite specific to the business of aggression and survival. In many other respects of their lives, they are extremely feminine, and they would be absolutely horrified at any suggestion that they were kind of butch in some way.
I always find it interesting to see what gender stereotypes some people conform to and which ones they violate. So I just find it interesting in this case that they'd violate the ones about aggression and still kind of maintain the ones about being the more passive person in a relationship.
Yes, they want, they certainly expect and want to be associated with kind of dominant men. They think that that's how men should be. You know, men should be the ones who decide and control and take charge and fight for you if necessary and so on. So in that sense, they have very traditional ideas about the kind of male-female relationship. It was quite surprising to me because in a sense, I almost expected to find a bunch of women that really kind of had thrown off the whole old-fashioned ideas about what it meant to be female, you know, and had taken on an entirely new kind of persona. But in many respects, I was actually surprised at how very, very conservative and traditional they are, not only about femininity, but about many things, patriotic beyond belief, you know, that they have many very old-fashioned ideas about the virtues of their homeland, the position of men and women, the importance of children, and so on. So in many ways, they're really surprisingly traditional, I think.
Let me ask you about violence in your family. I don't mean if your family was violent, but if you feel that you were socialized in the typical female ways when it came to expressing your aggressive feelings.
Oh, yes, yes, I'm sure that I was. I was, if I so much as sort of whimpered or my lip quivered, you know, to show that I was angry or upset at something that had been said to me, I was always told to go to my room until I had got control of myself. Now, that may be extreme and perhaps rather English, you know, but I think that there's very much the use of this term, get control of yourself, you know. And that's very much how I was brought up, that the demonstration of sort of extreme kinds of emotion was in some way embarrassing or really awkward, and that you should go and do it somewhere quietly where nobody could see you doing it.
I'm sure you'd like to see women achieve equality in every aspect of life, but do you want to see women achieve equality in violence? I mean, do you think that in some ways the female response of getting control or of really just using violence as an absolute last resort when you've completely lost control, do you find that to be a more, do you wish men were more like that?
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because, you know, the extremes of either side are awful. You know, if you imagine a world that was populated entirely by people that had an instrumental view of aggression, it would be absolutely horrifying, you know? I mean, would anybody want a woman who used aggression in that kind of way, you know, raising children, for example, you know? Obviously, we wouldn't. On the other hand, you think about the extremes of women's view, which is, you know, better bite your lip and cry into your pillow than ever for a minute sort of speak out or strike out against injustices that are being done against you. And that seems equally bad, you know. If I had to sort of say what I thought would be best, I think perhaps, you know, if you simply wanted to have some control over crime statistics, then I think that what we have to do is somehow create a situation where men come to understand in some fundamental sense that aggression is not a legitimate way of gaining respect. It may put you in control of a situation temporarily, but it does so by fear, by inducing fear in other people, and that there's an enormous difference between fear and respect. And I think that often among men, the two are very much confused.
Well, Anne Campbell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
That was fine. I enjoyed it.
Anne Campbell is the author of Men, Women, and Aggression. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the flood today?
Our colleague Robert Siegel is out in flooded Missouri. He'll have several aspects of today's situations with the rising waters there. Deborah Amos reports from Turkey on a plan to send thousands of troops from the Islamic countries, an idea to send troops from those countries to help the Muslim forces in Bosnia. Maria Inahosa reports on the difficulties faced by a Hasidic school district in upstate New York, and a conversation about the Baltimore Orioles ballpark, Camden Yards, the site of tonight's All-Star baseball game, everybody's newest favorite baseball park, real grass and blue sky, and old and new red brick.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Welcome to the camp. I guess you all know why we're here. My name is Tommy, and I became aware this year. If you want to follow me, you've got to play pinball. And put in your earplugs, put on your eye shades, you know where to put the caulk. Hey, you getting drunk? So sorry, I've got you sussed. Hey, you smoking Mother Nature? This is a bust. Hey, hung up old Mr. Normal, don't try to gain my trust. 'Cause you ain't gonna follow me any of those ways, although you think you must.
That's The Who from their 1969 rock opera Tommy. It's proven to be the most popular recording they ever made. The new Broadway production, called The Who's Tommy, mounted in collaboration with The Who's Pete Townsend, recently won 5 Tony Awards. Can Broadway do a credible version of a rock opera? Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to the new cast recording.
You want to be like Tommy? I'm glad you're not, I hope that's clear. You shouldn't try to ape my show, it isn't just pinball. You don't need to claim a share of my pain, you're normal after all. You might as well get drunk, so sorry, I've got you sussed. No instant high for free here, this is a bust. I didn't live out some fairy story, some rags to riches crawl. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, I couldn't talk at all.
When the British rock group The Who first released Tommy, people who didn't like it criticized the ambitious piece as bombastic, pretentious, and obvious. Who'd have thought that these are exactly the qualities that would help make The Who's Tommy a Broadway smash in 1993? The 1969 Tommy has always seemed overblown. Its pencil-thin story about a deaf, dumb, and blind kid who sure plays a mean pinball was barely able to support its windy, varied music. On The Great White Way, however, this flaw becomes an asset, because elemental rock and roll needs to be inflated, expanded, arranged, orchestrated, to fill a Broadway stage with sufficient drama, pacing, and glitz. The new cast album of The Who's Tommy documents the ways director Des McAniff has shrewdly reinterpreted Pete Townsend's creation.
Favorite table.
The soundtrack has been overseen by George Martin, best known as the man who produced all of the Beatles albums, and what Martin has achieved here is a peculiar hybrid. It's Tommy meets Miss Saigon and they join Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Grandiose absurdity that's frequently pretty fun. It's often impossible to listen to the smooth tenor of the Broadway Tommy, played by Michael Cerveris, without hearing the more raucous rasp of Roger Daltrey singing many of these songs. But it's best to approach the Who's Tommy soundtrack as its own creation. Where Daltrey, for example, yelled one of the album's climactic songs, I'm Free, as if he wanted to shred his vocal cords, Cerveris emits it with the careful exaggeration of an ironic cabaret crooner. And who's to say that elaborate irony doesn't suit that overheated 60s lyric better in the 90s?
I'm free.
As the sensory-deprived Tommy makes his way from troubled London youth to mystical messiah, The Who's Tommy becomes light entertainment with a vengeance, a rock show for people who think they're too old to go to real rock concerts. In collaborating on this, Townsend is surrendering, admitting that, in public opinion anyway, The Who never did anything that topped Tommy. In the liner notes, he writes, I have blushed to hear my small work so elevated. But that sounds false and annoying. Surely Townsend, one of the few egomaniacs in rock who's earned his vanity, doesn't think of Tommy as small. Nor is it low culture that needs the affirmation of a Broadway production to attain a higher artistic status. The Broadway Tommy is a clever curiosity that's making lots of money, but if you're looking to buy a Broadway cast album, you'd still be better off with Oklahoma.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me?
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Tommy, 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 can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy. Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a growing movement that says the Holocaust was a hoax. A recent poll suggests almost a quarter of American adults think the Holocaust may never have happened. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the growing assault on truth and memory with Deborah Lipstadt, author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.